Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're not just scratching the surface. We are going all the way down to the bedrock of what it actually means to be a living thing in the 21st century.
Yeah, this is a big one.
It is. We're tackling a riddle that I think everyone listening has felt this in their bones, even if they haven't quite put words to it. It's this massive, glaring paradox sitting right in the center of modern life.
It really is the elephant in the room, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, just think about it for a second. We are living in what should be the golden age of
Oh,
information.
for sure.
We have more medical knowledge than at any point in human history. We've mapped the human genome. We have antibiotics. We have MRI machines that can see inside your brain while you're,
The amount
thinking.
of data we have is just staggering.
It is. We have data coming out of our ears. I mean, how many people do you know right now who have a smartwatch tracking their heart rate variability, their sleep stages, their blood oxygen?
We've optimized everything. We are arguably the most managed humans to ever walk the earth.
Exactly. Managed, optimized to the gills. And on top of that, we have this wellness industry worth trillions of dollars that's designed specifically to make us feel good. And yet, and here's the kicker, the thing that just drives me crazy, chronic disease is skyrocketing.
It's everywhere.
Autoimmune issues are exploding. Burnout isn't even a clinical diagnosis anymore. It's basically the default setting for most adults I know.
It's just the state of play.
Yeah. And mental distress is climbing year over year over year.
And if you look outside our own bodies at the wider environment, you see ecological instability is almost perfectly mirroring that internal chaos.
Right. So the question we're really wrestling with today is simple, but it's also, I think, absolutely terrifying. Why are we getting so much better at intervention, but so much worse at actually staying well? Why does it feel like we're all running faster and faster just to stay in the same place?
It is the defining question of our time. It really is. It's the paradox that kind of breaks the current medical model.
So where do we even start to answer that?
Well, to answer it, we're not looking at a traditional medical study today. We're diving into a really profound, almost philosophical paper. It's titled The Cost of Staying Alive: How Living Systems Budget Survival, Remember Constraint, and Lose the Future.
Okay, that is a title.
It is. It's by Dr. Bechara Saley, and it was written in collaboration with some AI research partners, which is interesting in itself.
I have to admit, when I first saw the title, The Cost of Staying Alive, I thought it was going to be about healthcare prices.
A lot of people do.
Rising insurance premiums, the insane cost of insulin. I was ready to get angry about the economy.
Which is a completely valid anger to have, but that's not where this is going.
No, it's not about dollars and cents, or, well, it's not about those dollars and cents.
No, it's about a completely different kind of currency. It's about energy, attention, repair capacity, trust.
Okay.
What Dr. Saley is proposing here is a radical reframing of the whole problem. He's trying to move us away from the question doctors usually ask, which is, what is broken?
Right. What's wrong with you?
Exactly. And instead, he's forcing us to ask a much more fundamental and honestly a much scarier question. What does it cost this system just to keep going?
It's an accounting problem.
It is precisely an accounting problem. He calls it viability economics. And I want to be really clear here. This isn't just a clever metaphor he's using.
Okay.
He's arguing that this is the literal physics of being alive.
Okay, so let's unpack this, because this concept, this viability budget, it feels like the lens through which we have to look at everything else today, our bodies, our mental health, our whole society. It frames this entire deep dive. So where do we start with the budget?
Okay, so imagine your body is a household. You have a budget.
Right, income expenses.
Exactly. But instead of money, your income is energy. It's ATP from your mitochondria. It's your cellular resources, your redox balance. It's time, it's focus. That's what's coming in.
And the expenses are everything else.
Everything. Your mortgage, your groceries, your electric bill. Biologically, the expenses are every single time your heart beats, you pay. Every time you digest food, you pay. Every time you have to fight off a virus, or stress about a work deadline, or repair a muscle after a workout, you are writing a check from this biological account.
And just like a household, I guess you can't spend what you don't have. Or, I mean, not forever. You can put things on a credit card, maybe, but eventually that bill comes due.
Precisely. And this is where the core thesis of the paper just hits you like a ton of bricks. Dr. Cerrone argues that many of the things we label as diseases or dysfunction,
Like chronic inflammation,
sorry,
anxiety, metabolic issues.
all of it, He's saying they aren't actually mistakes. They aren't signs that the body is breaking.
Okay, then what are they?
They are rational, expensive strategies the body is using to avoid a total collapse.
Whoa. Huh. Okay, that is a huge flip of the script. So if I'm chronically inflamed, or if my cortisol is constantly through the roof, my body isn't necessarily failing me. I'm not broken.
No. From this perspective, your body is actually doing its job. It's spending money.
Yeah.
It doesn't really have to keep you safe from something it perceives as a major threat.
So it's making a budgetary decision.
It's a budgetary decision. It's allocating resources to defense, to immediate survival, rather than to long-term maintenance and repair.
Okay.
And to really understand why it makes that decision, we have to define what viability actually means in this paper. Because it's not what we usually think of.
Yeah, let's define that. Because when I hear viable, I think, oh, it worked. Like a viable business is a profitable business, but you're saying it's more specific here.
It's very specific and it's much more stark. In this paper, viability is defined as simply persisting without catastrophic failure.
That's it?
That's it. It is the absolute baseline requirement of life. It's not thriving. It's not flourishing or feeling good. It is just staying in the game.
Keeping the lights on.
Just keeping the lights on. But here's the catch, and this is so important. Everything has a cost. Every moment of focus, every immune response, every cellular repair process, it all requires an allocation of these finite resources.
And we don't choose the budget.
We don't choose the budget. Dr. Sehelly really emphasizes this. It's a biological constraint. You cannot negotiate with your mitochondria. You can't talk your liver into working for free. You have to pay the bill every single day.
So if that bill is mandatory, where does the trouble start? I mean, why are we all suddenly running such a massive deficit? If our bodies have been evolving for millions of years to do this exact thing, why are we suddenly so bad at it?
The trouble starts with what the paper calls misaligned conditions.
Okay, that sounds a bit like corporate jargon for life is hard, but break that down. What does a misaligned condition actually look like for a human body?
Think about it this way. When your environment fits your biological needs, when you have access to nutrient-dense food, when you sleep when it's dark, when you feel safe in your community, survival is cheap.
The rent is low.
The rent is very low. You spend energy, sure, but you replenish it easily. Your income more or less matches your expenses. You have a surplus left over to do other things, like grow, learn, play, repair that little scratch on your knee.
Okay, that's the ideal.
That's the ideal. But now just look at modern life.
Oh boy. Here we go. The list of doom.
Well, let's just start with food. We have ultra-processed food everywhere. Now, biologically, that food is fascinatingly expensive.
Expensive how? It's cheap to buy.
Cheap to buy. But metabolically, it's a huge expense. It demands enormous energy to process, to break down the weird fats, to manage the massive glucose spike, to deal with the chemical additives. But it gives very little actual repair value back.
So it's like a high-interest loan.
It's a payday loan for your cells. Yeah. High interest, very low return. So we're eating, but we're literally starving our repair budget.
Okay, that makes sense. What else?
Then you add environmental toxins, things we don't even think about. Mm-hmm. Pollution, microplastics in our water, endocrine disruptors in our household products.
Right.
All of those require your liver and your detoxification systems to work overtime. That is energy that could have gone to your brain or your muscles or your immune system, but now it's being diverted to constant waste management.
And then there's the social stuff. The non-physical stressors.
The chronic social stress, which might be the biggest driver of all. That email pinging at 11 p.m. The constant news cycle of doom and outrage. Financial insecurity. Social isolation.
Don't forget, lack of sleep.
And sleep deprivation, which is like closing the bank right when you're supposed to be making your biggest deposits. You're just cutting off your primary income stream.
So the rent just went up dramatically.
The rent skyrocketed. This is what the paper calls the silent escalation. The baseline cost of just staying alive has gone up, but our biological income, our ability to generate energy and repair, hasn't kept pace. In fact, because we're often more sedentary and indoors, it's probably gone down.
So what does the body do when income is down and expenses are way up?
It doesn't just quit. It doesn't shut down immediately. It's smarter than that. It reallocates.
It robs Peter to pay Paul.
Precisely. It starts stealing from the growth and repair and thriving fund to pay the immediate defense and survival fund. It stops fixing the leaky roof so it can pay the security guards standing at the front door.
And the takeaway from this is, I mean, you said it's heartbreaking but validating.
It really is. We so often feel like we are failing. We feel tired. We feel brain fogged, anxious, sluggish. We blame ourselves.
Yeah. Why can't I get it together?
Exactly. But biologically speaking, from this perspective, we are furiously succeeding at surviving. We are doing exactly what our biology is programmed to do to stay viable in an incredibly expensive environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's costing us everything.
That really hits hard. We are furiously succeeding at surviving. So that brain fog isn't me being lazy or stupid. It's my brain literally saying, hey, we can't afford to run high-level cognitive processing right now.
Yes.
Because we need that energy to manage the inflammation in your gut from that food you ate or to deal with this massive spike in cortisol from that stressful meeting.
It's an austerity measure. Your body is acting like a responsible, if panicked, accountant. And it's saying, cut the budget for creativity. Cut the budget for patience. Cut the budget for libido. Cut the budget for long-term planning. We need all hands on deck for immediate survival.
This feels like a perfect bridge to the next big concept in the paper, which I have to say, this might be my favorite part because it explains the feeling of health better than anything I've ever heard before. The concept of margin.
Margin is everything. In this framework, health is not defined as the absence of symptoms.
Which is how we usually think of it. I'm not sick, so I must be healthy.
Right. But you can have no obvious symptoms and still be right on the brink of total collapse. You're just one bad day away from a crash. In this view, health is defined as the presence of margin.
Okay, so define margin for us in this specific context.
Margin is the gap. It's the space between what you need to spend just to stay alive and what you actually have available in your account.
It's the slack in the system.
It's the slack. Oh. It's the buffer. It's the wiggle room.
It's the savings account.
It's the savings account, but it's also more than that. It's the empty space on your calendar. It's the extra emotional bandwidth you have to deal with a toddler having a complete meltdown without you having one too. Margin is what lets you handle a bad day or a stomach bug or a surprise bill without the whole system falling apart.
And without margin, what happens then?
Without margin, you are brittle. You might look fine on the surface. You might be getting through your day. But one small thing, a flat tire on the way to work, a rude comment from your boss, a minor infection, and you just shatter.
Because there was no buffer. There was no room to absorb the shock.
None at all. You were already redlining just to get by.
This connects so well to another term the paper uses, one that I had never heard in a biological context before. I've only ever heard it in finance or like life strategy. The term is optionality.
Yes. Optionality in this framework is the true measure of health.
Okay, what is it?
It's the ability to have multiple future choices.
Break that down for me. Why is having a choice a biological concept?
Think about a truly healthy system, one with lots and lots of margin. It can experiment. It can afford to take risks. It can decide to go for a long run, or it can decide to take a nap. It has the resources for either. It can adapt to a new diet. It can change careers. It has the energy reserves to try new things and see what happens.
It's flexible.
It's flexible. But a stressed system, a system with low margin, loses its optionality, becomes rigid. It can only do one thing.
Survive right now.
Survive right now. Its entire budget is allocated to that single non-negotiable task.
You know, it's the difference between having enough savings in the bank to quit a toxic job and take a few months to look for a new one.
Right. You have options.
Versus living paycheck to paycheck where you have to stay in that toxic job because missing even one paycheck means you lose your house. You have no other choice.
That is the perfect analogy. Yeah. And the paper argues that this exact thing happens biologically too. When you are low on margin, your body loses the option to relax.
Because relaxing is a luxury it can't afford.
Exactly. It loses the option to properly digest food because it's stuck in a fight or flight state. It loses the option to repair long-term tissue damage because all its resources are focused on the immediate perceived threat.
So that feeling of being rigid or stuck in your ways, it might not be a personality flaw. It could just be a budget constraint. If I feel like I can't change my habits, it might be because I literally cannot afford the energy that change requires.
That is exactly the argument. And this is where the paper makes a really profound point about trauma. It says that trauma and chronic stress are, at their core, fundamentally a loss of optionality.
A loss of optionality.
Your world just narrows. You stop seeing possibilities. Your future shrinks down to just getting through the next hour or the next 10 minutes.
I think we've all felt that narrowing at some point, that tunnel vision where you literally cannot think about or plan for next week because today is just too much.
That is your biological system telling you, we have no optionality left. All future projects are on hold. We are liquidating the future to pay for today.
Okay, so if our bodies are running these incredibly complex budgets and liquidating assets like the future, how are they keeping track of all this? I mean, I have a spreadsheet for my finances. What does the body have?
Right. This brings us to the next section on implicit memory. And this part, for me, it just blew my mind because I always thought memory was just, you know, remembering things.
Me too. A story in your head.
But this is where it gets really fascinating. The question is, how does the body keep score? We usually think of memory like a movie reel playing in our heads. I remember the time I fell off my bike. I remember my graduation day. That's what psychologists call explicit or declarative memory.
The story.
The story. But Dr. Sally is talking about something else entirely. He's talking about implicit memory.
Which is memory beyond storytelling.
Exactly. Implicit memory doesn't remember what happened. It remembers what it cost.
Whoa. Okay. Say that again. That feels really important.
It doesn't remember the event. It remembers the price tag. It functions as a kind of bias or a prediction engine. If the past was expensive, if surviving a particular situation required a huge amount of adrenaline, inflammation, and vigilance, the body's accounting department makes a note. And it budgets for the future to be expensive, too.
So if I grew up in a chaotic household where I always had to be on guard, my body didn't just store the stories of what happened.
Yeah.
It recorded the cost. It has a line item that says, being alive costs a lot of vigilance.
Exactly. And it takes that cost and sets it as your new baseline. This is the mechanism the paper calls set point drift.
Set point drift. That sounds like a glitch in a thermostat.
That is exactly what it is. A perfect analogy. If you are under constant prolonged stress, your body changes what it considers normal. It literally shifts the thermostat up.
It recalibrates.
It recalibrates. It says, okay, apparently normal life now requires high blood sugar, high blood pressure, and high muscle tension. That's just the cost of doing business around here.
And it does this even if the danger goes away.
And that's the trap. That's the tragic part. Even if the danger goes away, you leave the chaotic home, you quit the stressful job, the accounting entry from the past remains. The thermostat is still set to high alert.
Why? Why wouldn't it reset?
Because the body is fundamentally conservative. It's built for survival, not happiness. It thinks, well, it was dangerous before, it could be dangerous again. Better stay ready just in case. It's easier to stay on high alert than to constantly ramp up and down.
Can you give us some specific physical examples of this? What does set point drift actually look like in the body?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the major examples the paper uses is metabolic memory. If you've spent years in a state of high stress, your body might keep your blood sugar constantly elevated, even if your diet is perfect.
Why would it do that?
Because in a crisis, what do you need? You need quick energy for your muscles to run or fight. Glucose is that quick energy. So your body is basically predicting you're going to need to sprint away from a tiger at any second. It's keeping the engine revving just in case.
So when you go to the doctor and they say your fasting blood sugar is high, it might not just be what you eat for dinner. It's your body predicting a war is about to break out.
Precisely. It's an adaptation that has become a liability. Another great example is fascial or postural memory.
Okay.
Think about how you hold your shoulders when you're tense or stressed. They creep up towards your ears, right?
I'm literally doing it right now. I just consciously dropped them.
We all are. That bracing, that tension is a protective strategy.
Yeah.
It's like you're creating armor to shield your neck and organs from an attack.
It's an ancient response.
A very ancient response.
Yeah.
But if you do that every day for 10 years, your connective tissue, your fascia, actually remodels itself. It gets thicker and stiffer to support that braced position more efficiently. You literally build the armor into your physical structure.
So the memory isn't just in my brain cells. It's literally in my connective tissue. It's in the meat of me.
It's everywhere. It's in the stiffness of your back. It's in the resting rate of your heart. It's in the sensitivity of your gut lining. The paper describes this state as the body spending purely on interest payments for a debt that might not even exist anymore.
Wow.
You're paying for a war that ended 5 years ago, but your body never received the peace treaty. It's still on a war footing.
That is such a powerful and sad image, paying interest on a war that's over. And I have to assume this connects directly to inflammation, which is the big bad wolf of health right now. Every health influencer is talking about anti-inflammatory diets.
We do, and this is a perfect segue into the next section, reframing inflammation and trauma. The standard narrative we always hear is that inflammation is a mistake.
Right, it's a disease process.
It's your body going haywire, and the goal is to suppress it. Take an anti-inflammatory, drink some turmeric tea, just make it go away.
But Dr. Sakili is saying that's the completely wrong way to look at it.
He argues that chronic low-grade inflammation isn't a mistake at all. It's a maintenance cost. Think of your inflammatory cells as the body's security guards.
Okay, security guards. I like that. That makes sense.
In an acute, normal situation, like you cut your finger, the security guards rush to the scene, they patch up the hole, they fight off any invading bacteria, and then when the job is done, they go home.
That's good inflammation. It saves your life.
It's essential. But what happens if your body believes you are living not in a peaceful neighborhood, but in a perpetual war zone? What if you are constantly eating foods that irritate your gut lining or breathing polluted air or just swimming in a sea of cortisol from chronic stress?
The security guards can never go home. They can't clock out.
They stay on double shifts forever. They're constantly patrolling the entire system looking for threats, and that constant state of alert costs a fortune in energy.
And it causes damage.
It causes a huge amount of collateral damage to the surrounding tissue. But the body is doing it because it believes it has to. It believes the threat is real and imminent.
So when we take anti-inflammatories or follow an anti-inflammatory lifestyle without changing the underlying conditions,
it's like firing the security guards while a riot is still happening just outside your front door.
You're not solving the problem.
You might silence the alarm for a little while, but the actual breach is still happening. You aren't fixing the budget. You're just hiding the bill from yourself.
This brings us to another really heavy concept in the paper, which is trauma without a vent. Because, like we said, usually when we say the word trauma, we think of a car crash or a war zone or an assault. We think of a big identifiable event.
Yes, an event with a capital E, a specific point in time. But the source introduces this idea of trauma without a vent. And this is the result of prolonged exposure to unaffordable conditions.
Unaffordable conditions. That's a key phrase.
It's the whole ball game. Years of bad sleep. Years of financial precarity. Never knowing if you can pay your rent next month. Years of feeling emotionally or physically unsafe in your key relationships. Or just the cumulative grinding burden of modern life. This erodes your margin just as effectively, if not more so, than a single catastrophe.
It's death by a thousand cuts.
It is. Each cut is small, maybe unnoticeable, but the cumulative blood loss is immense. And the paper gives us a definition of trauma that I think is going to stick with our listeners for a very long time. I know it stopped me in my tracks when I first read it.
Okay, let's hear it.
The paper defines trauma as the forced liquidation of optionality.
The forced liquidation of optionality. Wow, that sounds almost like a legal term, like a bankruptcy proceeding.
It is a biological bankruptcy. That's exactly what it is. To survive the immediate moment, the system is forced to sell off its future possibilities at a steep discount.
Unpack that for me. What does it actually mean to sell off the future?
It means you trade long-term health for short-term survival. You stop repairing your DNA so you can make more adrenaline today. You stop learning new things so you can spend that energy scanning the environment for threats right now.
So your behavior changes.
Your behavior narrows. You become rigid.
Mm-hmm.
You stop planning ahead because you literally cannot afford the energy it takes to imagine a future, let alone build one.
This explains so much about the feeling of burnout. You know that feeling when you're completely burnt out and someone asks you a simple question like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And you just, you want to cry.
Yes. Or just stare blankly.
Yeah. Because you literally cannot care about the future. You have liquidated it. You've cashed it in to survive today.
Exactly.
Right.
You aren't depressed in the traditional psychiatric sense. You are biologically overdrawn. You have no currency left in your account to invest in a speculative asset called tomorrow. All of your currency is being spent on the emergency of right now.
So naturally, the response from society, and let's be honest, from ourselves, is to try and fix this. We try to hack our way out of it. We try to optimize. We track our sleep. We maximize our productivity. We biohack our diets.
We do.
And this is where the paper just throws a huge wrench in the gears of the entire self-help and productivity industry.
It really does. This section on the false promise of optimization is critical. As a culture, we are obsessed with efficiency. We want to be productivity machines.
Yeah.
We want to optimize our sleep, our diet, our workflow, everything.
But the warning here from Dr. Saheeli is pretty stark.
He warns that a system that is 100% efficient has 0% margin.
Zero slack.
Zero slack.
Can you give me an analogy for that? Because in my head, efficiency is almost always a good thing.
Okay, think of a highway system. If a highway is optimized to be 100% full, to maximize the number of cars moving per minute.
One car just taps its brakes and you have a 10-mile traffic jam instantly.
Exactly. That is a brittle system. It creates gridlock from the smallest perturbation. A resilient highway system, on the other hand, has empty space. It has inefficiency built into it.
And that empty space, that's the margin.
That's the margin. That empty space allows other cars to maneuver around a breakdown without stopping the whole flow. It absorbs shock.
So when we try to optimize our lives down to the minute, you know, wake up at 5 a.m., meditate for 10 minutes, work out for exactly 20, blend the perfect smoothie, answer emails in the first hour, we are actually creating a brittle system for ourselves.
We are systematically eliminating all the slack. So when one small inevitable disruption happens, a kid gets sick, a meeting runs late, the internet goes out, we crash. We spiral into overwhelm.
Because there's no buffer.
There's no buffer. Resilience, he argues, actually requires inefficiency. It requires redundancy and rest and unscheduled time.
That is so deeply counterintuitive to our entire culture. We need to be inefficient to be healthy.
We need to be buffered. And this explains why healing is so damn hard for so many of us. The paper calls this the structural blockade.
The structural blockade. That sounds like the reason why all my New Year's resolutions to get it together eventually fail.
It's the paradox of healing. And it's a real catch-22.
Yeah.
To change, to reconsolidate those old expensive memories, to lower that thermostat set point, the body needs to feel safe.
Okay, that makes sense.
But to feel safe, it needs to change its patterns.
It's a total catch-22. You can't feel safe until you change, but you can't change until you feel safe.
And here is the key rule from the paper that unlocks it. It's a simple sentence. Reconsolidation requires surplus.
Surplus.
You cannot heal while you're still barely breaking even.
Yeah.
You need extra energy, extra safety, extra resources to even risk letting your guard down.
Because letting your guard down is inherently risky.
It is incredibly risky. If your body's implicit memory is screaming that you're in a war, then putting down your shield feels like an act of suicide. Your biology will not do it unless it has a massive surplus of safety signals telling that the war is truly, truly over.
So, if your current environment, your food, your job, the pollution in your city, your relationships, is still taxing you every single day, no amount of positive thinking or meditation is going to fix the underlying budget.
Correct. You cannot out-meditate a structural deficit. If you are breathing toxic air and working a 60-hour week in a fear-based corporate environment, your body is correctly identifying that you are under siege.
Right.
Trying to force it to relax in that environment is actually a form of biological gaslighting. You're telling your nervous system that what it's perceiving isn't real.
This removes so much shame. I think so many of us feel like we aren't trying hard enough to heal. We're not doing enough yoga or meditating correctly.
Yes.
But this reframes it completely. It's not about a lack of effort. It's about the mathematical fact that you are structurally overdrawn.
It shifts the blame from the individual's willpower to the individual's conditions. It's not that you are weak. It's that the cost of your survival is currently higher than your income.
And this isn't just about us as individuals, right? The paper makes a point to scale this up. It says this isn't just happening to our bodies. It's happening to everything.
This is the fractal nature of debt. This is where Dr. Saheeli connects the dots from a single cell all the way up to civilization. The same math, the same accounting principles apply at every level.
So let's talk about ecological trauma. How does that fit in?
Well, what are we doing to the planet? We're extracting resources. Lumber, oil, topsoil, clean water, faster than nature can replenish them.
We're running a deficit.
We are running a massive civilizational overdraft. We are liquidating the Earth's future optionality for our present consumption.
We're burning the furniture to heat the house for one more night.
Exactly. And you see the same pattern with institutional brittleness. Think about companies or governments that cut all the slack to be hyper-efficient. They fire all the redundant employees. They keep zero inventory on hand.
They optimize for quarterly profits.
They optimize for short-term efficiency. And in doing so, they lose their ability to adapt to any kind of crisis.
We saw this so clearly with supply chains during the pandemic. One ship gets stuck in a canal.
And suddenly you can't buy a toaster or a car part in Ohio.
Because there was no margin. There was no buffer in the system. They optimized for efficiency, and in doing so, they sacrificed viability.
They did. And the paper has this other term, coherence margin erosion. It sounds technical, but the concept is actually really simple and really scary.
What does it mean?
It means that when margins get thin, all the different systems become tightly coupled. A problem in one area immediately and catastrophically crashes everything else.
Okay, give me an example in the body.
In a body with plenty of margin, you can have a bad night's sleep and still have a decent day. Your systems are buffered from each other. But in a body with no margin, a bad night's sleep immediately causes a gut flare-up, which immediately causes brain fog, which immediately tanks your mood into a depressive episode. The systems lose their independence.
It's like everything is glued together in a bad way, a cascade of failures.
Yes. A healthy system has compartments. It can have a bad knee without having a bad mood. A system without margin is a house of cards. One puff of wind and the whole thing comes down.
Okay, this is heavy. We've established that we are fundamentally overdrawn, our optionality has been liquidated, and we are paying interest on ancient wars we don't even remember.
It's a bleak picture.
It is. Please tell me Dr. Sakili offers some solutions. How do we start to get out of this biological debt?
He does. But the solutions are not quick fixes or hacks. They're about fundamental shifts in strategy. The core solution, the mission, is simple to say, but hard to do. Restoring margin.
So the goal is not fixing the broken part, like the thyroid or the gut.
No. He says healing is not fixing a machine. It is restoring a budget. The entire goal is to incrementally, slowly widen that gap between what comes in and what goes out.
So how do we do that? What are the practical, real-world ways to restore margin?
He breaks it down into biological investments and social investments. Biologically, it's all the unsexy, boring stuff that we know we should be doing. And at the top of the list is sleep protection.
Sleep is the ultimate deposit into the viability account.
It is the only time the bank is truly open for major deposits and repairs. And right next to that is nutrient-dense food. Not just calories, but actual repair materials. Real food provides the literal building blocks to fix the collateral damage.
And socially, what are the social investments?
Predictability and trust. This is huge. If you can make your life even a little more predictable, your body doesn't have to spend as much energy on constant vigilance and threat scanning.
So routine is actually a way of saving energy.
A good routine is a massive cost-saving measure. And trust, having people in your life you genuinely trust, where you can let your guard down, that lowers your security guard budget because you can outsource some of that vigilance to the group.
That's why loneliness is so expensive biologically. You have to be your own sentry 24/7.
Precisely. Connection is a direct cost-saving mechanism for the nervous system.
I love the analogy you used earlier from the paper about paying down the principal on the debt.
Right. Most of what we do in modern wellness is just paying the interest. We take caffeine to fight fatigue. We take pills to manage the symptoms. We're just servicing the debt so we don't default.
But the debt itself remains.
It remains. Healing, in this model, means paying down the principal. You do one small thing that actually lowers the overall debt. You go to bed 1 hour earlier. You say no to one obligation you don't have the energy for. You buy back a tiny sliver of slack.
And the paper gives a warning here about awareness without overwhelm. Because honestly, listening to all of this, I feel a little bit overwhelmed. It feels like the hole we're in is so deep.
And Dr. Staley anticipates that reaction. He says the danger of a deep dive like this is realizing just how expensive modern life is and getting completely depressed and hopeless.
Which is a real risk.
It is. But he offers an antidote. He says, use this framework as an orientation, not an accusation.
So stop asking what is wrong with me.
And start asking, what is my current overhead cost? It just completely changes the conversation you have with yourself. Instead of beating yourself up for being lazy or unmotivated, you could look at your situation and say, oh, my body is engaging in very conservative accounting today because I haven't slept well in 3 days and I had a major deadline yesterday.
It allows you to be curious instead of cruel to yourself. Why is my internal accountant cutting the budget for happiness today? Oh, I see. Because we're massively overdrawn on the immune system account.
Exactly. It reintroduces a gentle form of agency. You stop trying to fight your body and you start trying to help it balance its books.
And we have to talk about the ethical implication here at the end. This isn't just a self-help model for individuals. It's about how we design our entire world.
This is the final, powerful message of the paper, designing for viability. He says whether we are designing a diet for a person, a workflow for a company, or a layout for a city, the primary question must be, does it preserve or restore margin?
And if a system extracts more than it replenishes?
it is creating trauma, period.
That's a heavy statement.
It is. If a company demands 80 hours of work a week from its employees, it is liquidating their optionality. It is creating trauma. If a food system produces cheap calories but destroys topsoil and pollutes water, it is creating ecological trauma. We have to stop praising extraction and start valuing replenishment.
It brings us right back to that haunting line you mentioned from the conclusion. The future is not lost because survival required sacrifice. It is lost when sacrifice remains invisible.
That is the takeaway. For so long, we have been pretending that staying alive and well in this modern world is free or easy. It is not. It is incredibly expensive. And until we make that cost visible, until we acknowledge the bill, we can't even begin to pay the debt down.
So for everyone listening, look at your own life's budget, not your bank account, but your viability budget. Where are you liquidating your future to pay for today? Where are you selling off your own optionality, your own choices? And maybe most importantly, what is one small, unsexy thing you could do today? Not tomorrow, today. Maybe it's just going to bed at 9 p.m. Maybe it's skipping the gym to take a nap, to buy back just a little tiny piece of margin.
It starts with one small deposit.
It starts with one deposit. Dr. Savely's paper is a profound wake-up call, but it's also a permission slip. A permission slip to rest, to refuse to be 100% efficient, and to start the slow work of reclaiming your slack. Thanks for diving in with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We'll see you in the next deep dive. And until then, stay viable out there.